Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Welcome, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are back with you again, and we are very pleased to welcome Jeremy from Cask X. Jeremy is the founder and CEO. And we're going to talk a little bit about, this is a little different than what we've done in the past, right? I mean, usually we're talking to a distiller or something like that. Jeremy is works with in finance. So he's running a fund, a hedge fund, that is an alternative investment hedge fund where you can invest in whiskey, which is pretty cool. And so tell us why you started this, Jeremy, and, you know, How did you get here? Because you have, in some of, you told me before, you have investments kind of all over the world. So how did this all begin?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. Answer to your question, I've been involved in alternative assets over the years, mainly passion investments. Mm-hmm. So initially, we were involved in wine investment in Asia, mainly in Singapore. Then we were running a business in Chinese contemporary art investment, believe it or not, in Hong Kong.
Nice.
And prior to selling the business in Hong Kong, of course, we had a huge database of alternative investors.
Right.
And we would meet up occasionally, or we'd field inquiries, and they'd ask us about investing into whiskey. Hmm. So obviously, a little bit of due diligence. And you know, we established that it wasn't a dissimilar business or a business model from selling art or selling wine for investment.
Right.
It's something that, of course, people love and are very passionate about.
Yeah.
And there is the opportunity, if certain boxes are ticked, to make money in that area. So
yep.
When I sold the business, I was precluded from selling art. I thought, okay, let's sell whiskey, and here we are.
Yeah, wow. So and where did the did you start with bourbon or scotch or both?
Yeah, no, good question. So initially the plan was to open the first office here in Los Angeles, and I was busy running around in LA in March 2020, ready to sign a lease on an office. So the first office we opened was actually in Sydney, Australia.
Okay.
And It was kind of a different way to start a business. The staff that were going to come and work here in LA from all over the world, literally, some in Taiwan, Singapore, the US, Australia, UK, of course, that they couldn't travel. So we set up the business completely remotely. And it worked out very well because initially, of course, we were selling barrels, I should say. So initially, we were sourcing barrels of new make from Scotland. New make is
right.
So literally just on into the barrel, ready to go.
Not aged yet.
Not aged at all. So literally, you know, when you buy it, it's literally kind of one day old, as it were. And the business went very well because a big factor was that everybody was picking up the phone. Everyone was picking up. People weren't wasting money on holidays, I
right.
guess. Hey, well,
or you weren't dodging calls either. They were like, please call me, talk to me.
Yeah, the business went very well initially. We very quickly opened a second office remotely in Hong Kong.
Right.
Because I've got this huge database of alternative investors mm-hmm. that have built up over the years. And finally, after I got government permission to travel, I was able to come to LA in November 2020 and open the first business here. Initially, again, selling Scotch whiskey barrels to investors. Okay. So we would, you know, we'd buy, you know, for example, say 1,000 barrels from Scotland and then sell them in smaller quantities, you know, 50 or 100 here to investors in the US.
Right.
The barrels, of course, had to be stored in Scotland. They have to be stored in a bonded facility in Scotland. So, of course, the business went very well initially again. But we were asked fairly soon, can we get bourbon?
Right.
And it was always the plan, of course, an American product in America for Americans.
Right.
So we reached out to one or two distilleries in Kentucky and Tennessee. We did one or two deals. And now 95% of what we do, I would say, is bourbon in America for American investors.
That's great. And I think it's important for people to understand when you talk about the new make, and you, do you mind if I show the bottle?
Please. No, please. Yeah.
Okay. So this, Jeremy sent this to me, and this is from Bardstown. I mean, it's just white. It's white lightning. There's no color. Corn mash. You know, if you've been to a distillery and you walk around, you see those giant vats of corn, and doesn't smell particularly good. But then after some number of years, you end up with something like this. And that is a bit miraculous, right? That is pretty crazy. This is a rabbit hole that Jeremy sent me. It's a high gold Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. It's a high rye double malt. Very, very interesting bottle and beautiful color. And so what people don't, maybe they've heard about it, but they didn't really recognize that the barrel gives it all the color. The barrel gives it 80%+ of the flavor. So it's that aging process. So not to speak for you, Jeremy, but I think the part of the investment thesis here is you start with this and you end up with the other stuff. So it's getting better with age.
Exactly.
It's just difficult, right? But this is a product where, you know, when you sell it to your customers, you know, like me or whatever, you end up with something better than what you started with just through the aging process.
Exactly. I mean, I think I believe it's one of the few assets that if market conditions stay exactly the same, so there's the same amount of buyers, same amount of sellers, it will increase in value over time. And that there's very few assets that could say that, because most assets are obviously governed by market conditions.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's a wonderful example to see the new make. And when we're engaging with investors or at events, we always take new make with us.
Right.
Because, of course, people look at it and go, right, okay. It looks like something that actually, you know, smells or tastes a bit like nail polish remover.
Right. Jeremy convinced me, you got to try this. I'm actually tasting like it tastes kind of, I don't know, it tastes kind of rye. I'm tasting the rye in here. I'm tasting, you know, pepper notes and, you know, things along those lines.
It's a wonderful example, I think. And, of course, it's enhanced by this. But when you see, like you say, you know, yeah, the rabbit hole, yeah, you know, these wonderful amber colors.
It's beautiful.
Again, it comes from the barrels. And like you said, the barrel gives the flavor as well.
So you take some of your, or many of your investors on the tours to Kentucky, right?
We do, yeah. I mean, so first of all our investors are accredited investors. So this is considered security for SEC purposes.
Yep.
And yeah, it's something that from day one, we didn't do, but we had one or two inquiries from investors saying, look, can we go to the distillery?
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, why not? Of course you can. So we put one or two tours together. And it was only really when I joined the first, we call it a VIP tour, when I joined the first VIP tour, that I saw the kind of the emotion and the reaction from the investors, because as you know, most investments are, you know, hands off. You get a, used to be a piece of paper, or now it's probably an email.
Right.
And that's about as much involvement really as you've got. So actually going to the distillery, the place where you've invested, and meet these real Kentucky or Tennessee people that aren't, you know, they're business people, but they're not business people per se. Right. You know, it's all about the passion, and it's all about the making something that's really amazing to them. That's why they've become successful.
Yeah.
And when the investors see their barrels piled up, and they, you know, they stir the corn and they taste the wheat and they, you know, dip their finger in and they become part of the process.
Yeah.
It's a massive, it's like an emotional dividend.
Yeah.
So really there's two parts to it. There's the obvious financial benefits or dividend that's important. Right. It's, yep, it's underpinned by that. But I think the emotional dividend is what makes it so interesting and so exciting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's something that we really enjoy, and our clients get a lot from it.
Yeah, it's much more exciting than investing in stocks and bonds and stuff like that. You know, you're understanding the process of how they make this stuff and what they're doing, right? I mean, so these VIP tours must go very well.
No, they do. I think it's not just about the process. It's about the people. But when you meet the people behind it, then you get a greater enjoyment and understanding for the product that they produce.
Yeah.
So there's that. And of course, we make friends as well. Yeah. But I think I'm sure you're aware that anybody who's running, again, they're not just doing it for the money. This is not just the, right, I'm going to make a ton of money, because most people don't.
Yeah. So
of course, in order to make something that's truly world class, then there's a lot of love involved as well. So that, that passion isn't always obvious when you're just buying a bottle from a liquor store.
Right.
But when you see the distillery, and I think that also the contrast in the distilleries as well. If you go to Bardstown, for example, it's like a Swiss pharmaceuticals factory, where you could eat your dinner off the floor. The place is absolutely gleaming. It's the latest super high-tech equipment.
Right.
And then you go to, you could say, Castle and Key, for example.
Yeah.
Which is so traditional, and it's how you'd imagine like a distillery might have looked 150 years ago.
Right.
And you go to Kentucky Artisan Distillery and other R distilleries, and, you know, between the distilleries, but they all produce, ultimately, a brilliant product.
Right. What are some of the other...
So... We do a lot of due diligence. We might look at, you know, 10 or 15 distilleries before we narrow it down to one and say, right, let's deal with this distillery, if they will deal with us.
Right.
Not everyone will, of course.
Right.
But most are happy to monetize their hard work in day one, because one of the challenges of running a profitable distillery is, you know, in lots of cases, you're not getting paid for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, that's
a long time.
That's an accountant's nightmare. So what happens in a lot of cases, Castle and Key, perfect example, or Bardstown, they'll produce their own brand very successfully, but they'll also produce a new make for one or two companies like ourselves, which they can monetize immediately.
Right.
So that pays all the bills while they're experimenting and putting on new releases. And then over a period of time, they release these wonderful expressions that are 6, 8, 10, 12 years old, and they finally get paid for it.
Right. Do your investors get to pick how long it should be aged, or how much input do they get?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So legally, they have to hold for at least 1 year.
Okay.
Now, forget that, because nobody's making money in 1 year in whiskey investment.
So.
Just ignore that. So we include 8 years of storage, insurance, and taxes. But the money that's paid in advance, if you like, covers everything. You know, the sweet spot really for bourbon is 6 to 8 years in terms of, you know, good investment and monetization.
Yeah.
So we include that 8 years. So we suggest to our clients, look, hold the 8 years. If you have to sell earlier, sell. And there might be the odd occasion where, for whatever reason, 4-year-old barrels are fetching particularly good money currently. We'll go back and say, look, you know, do you want to trade these out? But as we talked previously, generally speaking, the longer the better. It's not rocket science. Eight-year-old whiskey is better than four-year-old whiskey. You can say carte blanche.
Absolutely. And do you assist your investors in selling?
We do, yeah. So again, it's completely hands off the investment, apart from the fact that you can go to the distillery and stir the corn. But after, let's say, 6 or 8 years, we'll go back to the investor and say, look, no, it's a good time to sell now. We can and will assist with that. Of course, they don't have to sell through us.
Right.
But we'll certainly assist, and we'll charge a 5% trading fee. So, you know, that's one of the ways we make our money at the back end. And it's, you know, it's a common interest. The more they sell for, obviously, the more we get paid as well.
Right, right. So you help to make the market, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, probably what a lot of your viewers or listeners are not aware, that a lot of the bourbon on the shelves, they don't actually make bourbon. In fact, probably the majority of bourbon brands that you'll see in a liquor store are what's called NDPs, non-producers.
Yeah.
So that essentially they'll go out to the market, they'll source aged barrels, they'll blend it. So there's consistency over a period of time, of course, for their brand. Slap a label on it, and you know, they'll buy the barrel on a Monday and they'll fill the bottle on a Wednesday.
Right.
If you like. So that creates a market where anybody who's holding really good aged barrels from a good distillery that has, to coin a wine term, good provenance, well, there is, it's been stored at the right place under good conditions, that's an asset that is very liquid and will sell for good money.
And it seems to me, I mean, correct me from your perspective if you think it's different, but, you know, right now, holding really good quality is what you want. You know, if it's not good quality, it's not as, because there's better aged product on the shelves because the whiskey market is not as hot as it was during COVID. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, there's two factors to that. One of it is there's better quality aged bourbon available, because at one point, you couldn't find anything older than 2 or 3 years. It's kind of ridiculous.
Right.
But what we are seeing in general is a similar trajectory to what happened with Scotch 15 or 20 years ago. 20 years ago, nobody drank single malt, hardly. I'd say no. There wasn't a great deal. It was basically blends. It was, Johnny Walker's, these kind of generic Scotches. And these great single malts went into the blends, which would be kind of really crazy now. But of course, once people started drinking single malt, then they start asking about the age statement. And then when they ask about the age statement, of course, you know, the longer is better. So any whiskey now, or any Scotch, I should say, that you see on the shelves, 90% of it has an age statement.
Yeah.
So bourbon's following a almost identical trajectory in that people are beginning to have an appreciation for more age statements.
Yeah.
So even the big brands, you know, Jim Beam, so on and so forth, more and more they're issuing like 10-year-old, 12-year-old.
Can it be aged too long?
It can, yeah. This Scotch is 72 years old. So just to give you an idea on that, there's no such thing as a 72-year-old, but you probably wouldn't want to drink it. I think once we start getting past 20 years, you've got to really manage it and monitor it.
Yeah.
Because of the climatic conditions, I'm sure you're aware of angel share, where it evaporates, depending on the humidity and the heat.
Yep.
So you, there's two things in play. One, you need some whiskey in the barrel at the end of the day. If it's all evaporated, it's kind of a waste of time. And two, what's left has to be of a high quality, and it isn't always the case. So that's why you see with Scotch and with bourbon, when you get these 20-year plus expressions, that they can be very, very expensive because they're super rare. And
so we've got some, you were kind enough to ship some Castle and Key and some Rabbit Hole.
Yeah.
this castle and key. It's beautiful here. This is a wheated. See the word wheated on here? So this is wheated, and it is Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 108 proof, small batch. So Castle and Key is literally made in a castle on the banks of a little river there that I've visited, and you know they do a really nice job. It's where Colonel Taylor was the original guy who started the castle thing, and then Castle and Key came along later and said, "We need to fix this place up. This place is amazing, and we need to make some really great bourbon out of here." And so that's what they started to do.
This is actually one of my favorite bourbons. It's got some age to it. I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, 6 or 8 years old, is it?
This one's 7 years.
There you go.
Yep.
Really? What a difference from the
it's interesting though. This one is wheated, and so you would think it would be a little more mellow. But I still feel like it's got some rye to it. You know, it's like baking spices. And I mean, definitely you got the vanilla and the caramel. But I get some pepper. I get a little bit of oak out of it. And it feels like it kind of explodes in your mouth a little bit. It's like, whoo, nice spice. You know, so it's wheated. But I think the mash bill has spice in it.
No, I got a lot of spice. And it's one of my favorites. It's a great place.
We've got the rabbit hole. Which is, now, it's called...
It's not as explosive on the nose.
Not as explosive on the nose.
But this I would assume, is around about 3 years old. So it's a really good example of the progression from...
I mean, you get marshmallow, you get the roasted grain taste, you get... I mean, it's high rye, and it's double malt. Mm. So I don't think there's any wheat in the mash bill here. Probably, let's see, 70% corn, 25% malted rye, and 5%.
And it's a great place to visit. Mm. Again, contrast. In the middle of Louisville. So, of course, for a lot of people, when they fly into the Bourbon Trail,
right,
it's a good starting point. And it's just it's a lovely contrast from, you know, a product that's made from corn and wheat and barley. But this is actually produced right in the middle of Louisville. And it's just
right. Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, this has been really enlightening. And if you're interested in investing in bourbon, we know a guy.
Okay. Lovely.
So get in touch, and we'll try to get people in touch with you, Jeremy. And, you know, this has been a great discussion, and we thank you for your time, and we thank you for the demonstration of the new make versus the good stuff that comes out after that happens. And, you know, and for the description of what you're doing, and it's really, it's innovative. Love it very much. Lovely.
No, thank you for having me. And hopefully we can catch up maybe at the Bourbon Festival.
Absolutely.
Again, if you haven't been, you need to go. It's if you love bourbon, it's the best place in the world.
Yep. I missed it last year, but I'm going to be there this year. Already made my reservation.
I'll see you there.
Sounds great. Have a great day, Jeremy. All right, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, here we are again for a episode of the shenanigans portion of our show. And I thought today that we would cover a topic in the whiskey world that was kind of interesting. It's been coming up a lot lately. I don't know if you've heard about the idea of barrel picks. So a barrel pick is when someone arranges to go to Kentucky and go to a distillery, and they bring out some barrels for you to taste. You find the one that really appeals to you, and then you buy the entire barrel. So you can put it back in storage and have it aged a little bit further, or you can just take it right there and they'll bottle it for you and label it for you and send it out to you. So, you know, how many bottles of whiskey do you get out of a barrel? Somewhere around 150 to 200, 220 at the most, something like that. So, you know, not too many individuals are going to go and do a barrel pick because what are you going to do with 200 bottles of the identical same whiskey? I mean, you better like it because you got to you know, nearly a lifetime supply. But, you know, the barrel pick is really has taken off. And let's go over that. So when did this start? So it really started in the 1980s and the 1990s. Programs started with some big distilleries like Buffalo Trace and Jim Beam. And mostly the people doing it were liquor stores, maybe a few premium bars, very niche relationship-driven kind of barrel picking going on. It was really in its, you know, infancy. And then the next phase, I'd say, was more like an expansion phase in the early 2000s. Some growth alongside with, you know, a little bit of a bourbon revival that was taking place at that time. In the 90s, bourbon was kind of out. Nobody really wanted it. And then in the 2000s, it really started to come around. Barrel picks became more prevalent. Single barrel programs became more prevalent. More distilleries were introducing these things. Private selection offerings were happening, which was pretty cool. You could go get a private selection, but it was still not mainstream, I would say. And then it started to accelerate in the 2010 to 2019 phase and really took off, of course, in the 2020s with COVID. But in the 2010-2020 phase, that 10-year period, the bourbon boom was really starting to happen. Retailers were aggressively adopting barrel picks, and they're putting it on the menu. They're saying, hey, we went to this distillery, we picked this barrel, we think it's great, and we put it on our menu. Social media became, you know, amplifying all of this activity. There were a lot of group picks happening. Enthusiast groups were really taking off. And then, wow, the explosion of bourbon popularity and during, you know, COVID in the 2020s. So explosion in demand and visibility. Private barrels are now used for all sorts of things. You can rebrand the whiskey. You can do community building. You can do investment positioning. This was really becoming a signal of status and insider relationships in the whiskey world. So very cool stuff. And it during those 20, 30, 40 years, things really did shift. I mean, barrel picks originally, really all about retail differentiation. Now, barrel picks, really all about status, about access to the good stuff, about an experience where you go and you taste them and you pick the one you really like the best, and even a potential asset. And the distilleries like this too, because you're buying a barrel that isn't really finished yet necessarily. It may be finished, but you know, it could still be sitting on their shelf for, you know, in their rickhouse for another, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And you're paying for it now and they're getting their money now. So they're accelerating their revenue stream and they're getting, you know, they have plenty of barrels. I mean, Heaven Hill has over 2 million barrels. I mean, to give you a barrel to, you know, to pick is not like they're missing out on anything. So the rise of this private barrel selections in Kentucky, it did create really kind of a new category of ownership, blending a little bit of consumption with some asset investment type characteristics. And, you know, Heaven Hill, Buffalo Trace, we've already mentioned those. It, because they're the large distilleries, it really signaled that barrel picking was cool. Barrel picking was interesting. It institutionalized barrel picking and legitimized the space. A barrel pick does give the buyers control, right? Control over which flavor profile you like the best. Control over aging characteristics, branding positioning. Effectively, you're building kind of your own micro label. And so we here at Whiskey Shenanigans are doing the same thing. We are going to build kind of our own micro label. We have attempted to do that or done it already with some flyover whiskey where we put our label on the bottles and we got a few bottles from them. That was great. We're not going to do a whole barrel from them. We're probably going to go with a larger, more prestigious outfit to do a barrel pick. But it's going to be a Whiskey Shenanigans. This is the plan. We'll see how well it pans out. The plan is Whiskey Shenanigans plus Bourbon Plus Magazine, do it together, and then we make it available to some large restaurant groups that we've been in contact with through the podcast. So we don't have to take all 150 to 220 bottles from that barrel. Urban Plus and Whiskey Shenanigans can never drink that much. So the restaurant groups are more than willing to take it off our hands and put our brand label on the menu. So in probably starting in Washington, D.C. or Northern Virginia, you're going to see Whiskey Shenanigans label with Bourbon Plus, and you're going to see, and this is going to take some time, by the way, this is not going to happen tomorrow, but you're going to see this start to unfold. And we're going to get some really nice barrel picks from some great contacts that we've made by doing the podcast. So there's this, to go on with, what this is all about, for investors, barrels are kind of like a alternative asset. Alternative assets are supposed to move not highly correlated with the stock and bond markets. An alternative investment like classic automobiles or bourbon barrels or something like that, they shouldn't be moving as much with the markets as, each individual stock, right? So people like alternative assets because they hold their value and they slowly increase in value and they have much less volatility than the market overall. There's a scarcity dynamic here too. Limited barrels, long aging cycles, it creates a natural supply constraint that supports, some premium pricing in the barrel picking area. And barrel picks are really getting common or more popular on the social media platforms. So we'll do photos at the Rick House where we're doing the actual barrel pick, the pouring, the tasting, all of this sort of stuff. It becomes a real social media event, and it just, it signals the access and the relationships that, you have as insiders, and then we can make that available. We can't resell it because we're not a retailer or a distributor, but we can have it offloaded to restaurant groups who resell it. So to get a Whiskey Shenanigans Bourbon Plus, it's going to take a little bit of time before we get into more of these restaurant groups across probably the Northeast first, which is, our home base. And then even farther than that. Enthusiasts are shifting a little bit from being passive to being more active. So these barrel picks are becoming much more popular. It deepens brand loyalty. It deepens expertise. Enthusiasts really love the idea of going out, getting their hands dirty in a Rick House, wiping away the dust and the cobwebs, pulling down that barrel that's been aging for the last 7 to 10 years and tasting that thing. And this is the one that I want. This is the one that really makes sense to me. So it's really cool. And the investment community has taken note as well. I mean, the investment community, if you've seen the some of the podcasts that we've done, start with New Make, which is just distilled whiskey that's not aged at all. And investors will often invest in this. This goes into the barrel and out comes a beautiful bottle of bourbon 8 years later. So investors are really very involved in this as well. And there's this really cool experiential component. Traveling to Kentucky is cool. Tasting sessions are cool. Rick House tours are cool. It adds an intangible, whether you're doing it for ROI or just for fun or just to be involved, which is kind of what we're doing it for. We're not doing it for ROI. We're doing it just to be involved. And it's kind of interesting and it's kind of fun. And we'll bring you that fun on Whiskey Shenanigans because that's what Shenanigans is all about. Who does all these barrel picks? Well, for the most part, it's not what I just described, Whiskey Shenanigans and Bourbon Plus. Bourbon Plus has done a couple. Whiskey Shenanigans hasn't. It's mostly liquor retailers. It's not really restaurateurs are not the number one, user of barrel picks. But we're going to bring that and make that a little bit more popular and accessible for the restaurateurs, which I think will be very cool and very popular in the end. Bourbon groups, private clubs are organizing outings to go to Kentucky and bring their members up and say, hey, you can be involved in this. Very cool.
You can split the barrels amongst all the members. Bars and restaurants, like I said, they're not the number one, but they are a part of this. Distributors are a part of this. Sometimes they'll coordinate barrel picks for key accounts. Corporate high net worth buyers, they're part of this. It's really taken off, and it's really an interesting way to go about getting some whiskey. And as you guys probably know, we've done the Flyover Whiskey where we created our own mash bill. We had it distilled for us. We had it aged for us. They sent it to us. Then I took it and I did some finishing techniques on it. And I got to say, turned out way better than I thought. Really, really good. So what we're going to do is we're going to get a barrel pick, and we may do some finishing, or we may just be satisfied with exactly as it is. We're going to put our Whiskey Shenanigans Bourbon Plus label on it. We're going to get it out to the restaurant groups, and then you'll be able to get it in the restaurants and the bars. That would be pretty cool. So that's our shenanigans for today, everybody.